Stay with us and we're going to show you how to take dead aim.
Take dead aim.
The importance of taking dead aim.
Welcome to Taking Dead Aim, a show dedicated to the game of golf and the people who play it in the Carolinas and around the world. Taking Dead Aim is a presentation of RBC Wealth Management and Academy Sports and Outdoors. And now, here's your host, the guy who will grant you a mulligan, but then remind you about it the whole ride home. Ask me how I know. Charlie Nance.
Hey, welcome back. Once again, we're Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter at @CLT_golf guy. One of my favorite guests that I have on the show is golf historian Peter Kessler. Peter loves to argue that there has only been one decent depiction of golf ever filmed, and that's the one between James Bond and Auric Goldfinger in 007's third outing. He talks about the lack of authenticity in equipment, swings, and action, and to a certain extent, I agree with him wholeheartedly. However, there have been a few golf movies that I highly recommend. The Francis We Met story, the greatest game ever played. I enjoy that very much. One of my favorite movies, period, is The Legend of Bagger Vance. And in terms of comedies, Kevin Costner's Tin Cup is epic. For most, though, who are we kidding? There is only one. Caddyshack. Well, today, we will talk in depth about this legendary movie with Chris Nashawaty, the film critic at Entertainment Weekly, who has written Caddyshack, the making of a Hollywood Cinderella story that came out this week. Also, we'll check back in with Erin Thorne, the women's golf coach at Wingate, newly named her conference's Coach of the Year and whose team hasn't finished lower than fourth in any tournament this season. They just won the conference title and they're heading to regionals. But we begin with Chris Nashawaty and his book about a movie featuring a place called Bushwood, where gambling is illegal, sir, and I never slice. Chris, before we get started talking about the movie Caddyshack and everything else, I got to know a couple things. I know you as a movie critic from Entertainment Weekly. Are you a golfer? Are you a sports fan?
I'm a huge sports fan, although my golf game is pretty weak. Not as bad as Rodney Dangerfield's in Caddyshack, but still not good.
Yeah, we'll get to the golf games of the cast coming up here in just a few minutes. So, were you and this is even weirder because you're a film critic. I know that if the movie Caddyshack comes out right now, like every other critic, you're going to give it reviews that rival a Spinal Tap album. You're going to crush this movie, but yet obviously it's in your pantheon of guilty pleasures for you to take the time to write about it.
Yeah, you know, the thing is, when you tell people that you're a movie critic, they always think that your favorite movie is going to be like Citizen Kane or Vertigo or some Ingmar Bergman film from Sweden. But the fact of the matter is, when I was growing up, the movies that I was raised on were Animal House and Stripes and Caddyshack and Vacation. So those are the movies that are probably the closest to my heart.
Well, it sort of reminded me of, I love the story of the late Gene Siskel. And not that Saturday Night Live wasn't a critical success, but it was, or not Saturday Night, Saturday Night Fever. But he owned and bid on and paid big money, and he actually owned the John Travolta suit from Saturday Night Fever. And I thought, that is so weird. But, you know, everybody has their favorites.
Yeah, I mean, you know, us critics, we're fans. Highbrow, lowbrow, whatever it is, there are certain movies that just connect to you. And for me, I don't own any Caddyshack memorabilia, but it is a dear movie to me.
Chris Nashawaty is the author of Caddyshack, The Making of a Hollywood Cinderella Story. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. Before we can talk about Caddyshack or the movie that begat it, if you will, Animal House, it's important that we recognize and talk about a guy named Doug Kenny. He is a good portion of the first half of your book. You can make an argument. Now, the name might ring a bell. Doug Kenny was the character of Stork in Animal House, the guy who led the band down the alley, if you're having trouble remembering the character. You can make an argument, and I think you made a pretty good one in your book, that Doug Kenny is actually sort of the godfather of contemporary American comedy.
I couldn't put that better myself. In fact, I wish I had that phrase when I was writing the book. Doug Kenny is a fascinating guy. And, you know, even when you talk to people like Chevy Chase and Bill Murray and you ask them who the funniest person they've ever known is, they, to a man, say Doug Kenny. He started at the Harvard Lampoon when he was going to school there, and he started the National Lampoon in 1970, which became, you know, sort of this real publishing sensation across between, like, Mad Magazine and The New Yorker, if you can imagine that. And then he wrote Animal House, and then he wrote Caddyshack. I mean, the run of comedy that he was on in the 70s was remarkable.
Yeah, I made a list here. You brought up Harvard Lampoon. That begat National Lampoon. You can make an argument that that begat Saturday Night Live, which begat Animal House, the Blues Brothers, and Caddyshack. And the guy at the beginning of all this and in the middle of all of it was Doug Kenny.
Absolutely. Yep, he is ground zero for this, for that generation of comedy. He is the man that, you know, not enough people know, but they certainly know his work if they don't know his name.
One other thing I want to touch on, we've mentioned it a couple of times before we get to Caddyshack, is you have to mention Animal House. Everybody loves Animal House. We all know the lines. We all repeat them. I had no idea what a groundbreaking comedy it actually was, that for a time it was the biggest money-making comedy in the history of American film. I think it was made for a budget of like $4 million, and in 1977 or whatever it was, it made $128 million. And to put that in math terms for you, that's so much money that Hollywood couldn't hide it, and they had to pay the writers points. And Hollywood never does that.
No, it's true. They joke that Hollywood accounting is, you know, designed so that you never see any more money after your original payday. But they could not hide the money that movie made. It's, you know, it was something new in comedy. It was subversive and satiric, and it took no prisoners. And it coming on the wake of something like Smokey and the Bandit, or, you know, George Burns as God and Oh God, or, you know, Clint Eastwood, you know, palling around with an orangutan in those monkey movies he made in the 70s. This was something that was a total breath of fresh air and wasn't afraid to break a little bit of China in the process.
Chris Nashawaty is the author of Caddyshack, The Making of a Hollywood Cinderella Story. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. All right, let's get to Caddyshack, and let's start with some of the casting. Now we look at the cast, and they're Mount Rushmore-esque. But back in the day, let's sort of explain who everybody was at the time. Let's start with Rodney Dangerfield. Who was he in 1979?
Yeah, you know, Rodney has a really interesting backstory. You know, he had started off in the 60s as a comedian, in the 50s actually as a comedian, and his career never really took off. You could argue that he was a little bit ahead of his time, but he had to give it up, and he became an aluminum siding salesman, and eventually started to go back to comedy in the 60s, where he started to finally catch fire. And then, before Caddyshack, he had been on this really volcanic run of performances on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. And every time he was on stage, he would just leave people, you know, just sobbing, crying, because he was so funny. And when he was cast in Caddyshack, even though he hadn't really been in any movies before and didn't know how movies were made, they were considering Don Rickles. But Dangerfield was so hot in The Tonight Show, they decided to go with him.
It's important to point out to so many who have never lived at a time where they didn't have 400 channels on their TV, just how big a deal it was to kill on The Tonight Show. Johnny Carson, every night when there were three networks and later four networks, he had a captive audience of tens of millions of people, and this was a big deal.
Yeah, I mean, he was really a kingmaker. To go on Carson and to do so well that he called you over to the couch after your set as a comedian, that was like being anointed the next big star. And, you know, every stand-up comedian, you know, Jerry Seinfeld, whoever, has a story about being called over to that couch, and it's like, you know, it's Christmas, it's your bar mitzvah, it's whatever. It's just your life is never the same the next day.
Chevy Chase was one of the original Not Ready for Primetime players that opened up on Saturday Night Live during that show's first season. He became the first real breakout star in comedy. When this movie was being made in 1979, reading as what you were writing, the point in his career, it reminded me of Eddie Murphy when he did 48 Hours and then Beverly Hills Cop. He was sort of at that point where he could get any movie made that he wanted as long as he was the star.
That's actually a perfect comparison, Eddie Murphy. Yeah, I mean, Chevy Chase, was the only character in the cast in the first season of SNL who not only was featured in a way that the others weren't, but he would actually say his name on TV. You know, I'm Chevy Chase and you're not, when he was doing Weekend Update. And he was pretty savvy about that. He knew that that was a way to turn himself into a household name. And he really popped on that show. And when he left after the first season to have a movie career, the cast members who were left behind, you know, Belushi and Aykroyd, all those guys, were a little resentful that he had left. And when Bill Murray replaced him, he was sort of... became the Avenger in a way. When Chevy came back to guest host in 1978, he and Bill Murray got in a fist fight because as the new guy, Bill Murray felt like he had to stand up for the cast members. And that led to a lot of tension that a lot of people feared would play out again on the set of Caddyshack.
There's a memorable scene in Caddyshack where that tension gets taken care of. We'll get to that in just a few minutes. Chris Nashawaty, author of Caddyshack, The Making of a Hollywood Cinderella Story, is our guest taking Dead Aim. Two more pieces of casting that I thought were interesting in your book. One, we all knew Ted Knight as Ted Baxter on The Mary Tyler Moore Show. The fact that he only won two Emmys, being nominated, I think you wrote six times, is stunning to me because he was perfect on that show. And he was hysterical in Too Close for Comfort. What I was totally unaware of was Ted Knight's military background. That was stunning to me. I had to read that twice.
Yeah, I mean, Ted Knight had lived such a life before he even became an actor. As you mentioned, he was a World War II hero. You know, he was on the front lines, awarded multiple times, and you know, he had been a ventriloquist in Providence. You know, he did kiddie shows. He did everything before Mary Tyler Moore came along. And you know, he had a little bit of trouble with the wild and crazy cast in the set of Caddyshack, who were, you know, they were all improvisers who would make up their own lines and not stick to the script. And Ted was a professionally trained actor who thought that, you know, you come to the set every day knowing your lines, and that's what you do. And it drove him kind of crazy. And I think a lot of the rage that he had, especially with Rodney, who was just making up stuff left and right, that played really well for his character, Judge Smales.
It's hard to imagine anyone other than Michael O'Keefe playing Danny Noonan. But someone who was really close to getting the part, and this is going to be even wilder, was Mickey Rourke. I can't picture it would have been so much darker of a character. Can you imagine brooding Danny Noonan?
It really did come down to those two, and it was a bit of a toss-up. They went with O'Keefe because he was a better golfer. But, yeah, I mean, Mickey Rourke is a pretty, pretty intense dude. It's not a wacky comedy with Mickey Rourke as Danny Noonan by a long shot.
And we're not done with Caddyshack, The Making of a Hollywood Cinderella Story by a long shot. Up next, author Chris Nashawaty continues to take dead aim at the story behind the most beloved golf comedy of all time, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. We're taking dead aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. We continue now with Chris Nashawaty, author of the newly released Caddyshack, The Making of a Hollywood Cinderella Story. The genesis for the idea of the movie Caddyshack did not come from Doug Kenny or Harold Ramis or anyone else who pitched it in Hollywood. It came from a guy named Murray, but not the Murray we've talked about.
Yeah, Brian Doyle Murray was the third writer with Doug Kenny and Harold Ramis. And the story was really his. And it was a very personal story because the Murray boys, well, there were nine Murray kids in all. And they were a working class family in a pretty ritzy neighborhood just north of Chicago. And in order to pay for Jesuit school, their father made them work as caddies and shag boys during the summer so they could pay tuition. And you know, when you're a caddy and a shag boy, you come up with a lot of crazy stories and you meet a lot of colorful characters. And so when it was time to pitch the follow-up to Animal House, they went back to Brian and they said, you know, tell us more about this Caddyshack idea. And that's what they pitched. And it's a very personal story to the Murray family.
you can't think of Caddyshack at all without thinking of the other Murray, and that's Bill Murray as Carl, the greenskeeper, or the assistant greenskeeper, excuse me, in Caddyshack. But when the camera started rolling, he wasn't even, the character wasn't even fleshed out. It wasn't even in the first two or three drafts of the script when Bill actually showed up on set, correct?
Yeah, that's right. Carl Spackler was a complete afterthought. The studio wanted one more star in the movie, and Brian obviously thought of his brother Bill, who at the time was just starting to take off on Saturday Night Live. So they got Bill to come and do it, but, you know, the character was such an afterthought that they hadn't written any lines for him. But knowing what a great improviser Bill was, you know, with his training at Second City in Chicago and on Saturday Night Live, they just knew that if they just left some blank pages for his scenes, he would appear on the set, they'd roll the camera, and he'd come up with gold, which is exactly what he did, because that Cinderella story scene that he does, that's in one take, and that's all ad-libbed.
Let's talk about improvisation and ad-libbing, because I don't think it's done nearly as much today in film as it used to be, and maybe it's a gap in talent that doesn't exist out there, or that Hollywood doesn't allow it to happen. I don't know, but I'm going to give you a list of scenes just in Animal House and Caddyshack that I know were improvised, and they're some of the most famous scenes in the world. You have Belushi on the stairs with Stephen Bishop smashing the guitar in Animal House. You have the whole cafeteria scene with Belushi and look at me, I'm a zit. Okay, you have Bill Murray doing the Cinderella story, and I want to talk about this scene now where you have Bill Murray and Chevy Chase in Carl's shack where he's growing a breed of grass that you can play on and smoke. All of these scenes, 100% improv, just with a premise given. That's amazing. Those are some of the biggest scenes in the history of comedy.
It is amazing. And I think the reason why they don't do it anymore, I think there are some actors who still do it a little bit. Someone like Will Ferrell, you know, and some of the Judd Apatow comedies, they do a little improv. But movies have become so expensive now, and they're such huge investments that no one is going to risk that kind of money on going into a film without a script. But back in 1979, when they were making Caddyshack, you know, we had a first-time director, a first-time producer, stars that hadn't been in movies before. And the movie didn't cost all that much. It cost $6 million. And so they just let these guys, since they were coming off Animal House and hoping for another Animal House, do whatever the hell they wanted. And that's what they did, and they just miraculously spun it into gold.
The book is Caddyshack, The Making of a Hollywood Cinderella Story. Author Chris Nashawaty is our guest, Taking Dead Aim. Just a quick aside, one more piece of casting that I had written down here that when I read it, I laughed out loud. For those of us who grew up and came of age in the late 70s and early 80s and remember the memorable jingles and TV commercials, when I saw this on the page and then I remembered the face, I laughed out loud. Tell everybody who Dr. Beeper was better known as on television.
Dr. Beeper was played by an actor named Dan Rezin, who was a sort of a jobbing, struggling actor whose previous claim to fame was as the Tidy Bowl Man.
Unbelievable! He was the Tidy Bowl Man in the boat in the toilet.
Perfect.
It was fantastic. Hey, as a member of Rolling Hills Country Club, legit, Rolling Hills Country Club in Monroe here in Charlotte, it pleased me to no end to see that same name for the club used as Bushwood. Does the club still exist?
It does. And now they have a different name now. It's called Grand Oaks. So you may be the only Rolling Hills now. But, yeah, it was Rolling Hills in Davie, Florida, and they originally wanted to shoot it in Illinois because the Murrays were from Illinois, and that's where they sort of envisioned it. But, you know, when they decided that they were going to shoot it in the fall, you can't really make a breezy summer comedy by Lake Michigan in the fall. So they went down to Florida and found this course that fortunately didn't have many palm trees and sort of looked like it could pass for Illinois, and they proceeded to just devastate the place, you know, with that giant explosion at the end of the film.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I've always wondered how in the hell they talked a club into letting them blow it up. Because this is the late 70s. We're not in the computer-generated age of creating explosions out of thin air. There was real dirt and pyrotechnics being used at a country club. How did they convince the club to let them do this?
One simple answer: they didn't tell them. They showed the board of Rolling Hills in Florida the script, and the explosion was in the script, and the board said, look, if you're going to do this movie here, you have to change the script. And they said, oh no, don't worry, the script will be changing. But what they didn't tell them is that part of the script wasn't going to be changing. So on the day of the explosion, one of the producers took all of the board members from the club out to lunch, lured them off campus, and then they just, while the mice was away, the cow was away, they just blew the whole thing up, and it was such a huge explosion, but they were in the flight path to the Fort Lauderdale airport. An incoming plane radioed into the control tower that there had been a plane crash.
The very first scene filmed for Caddyshack would become one of the most famous scenes in the movie. Yet the way it was filmed on day one never saw the light of day. Sort of explain what I'm talking about.
I think you're talking about the Dalai Lama scene?
Yes.
Yes, okay. So the Dalai Lama scene, there's a very not funny version of that speech in the script. And they gave it to this actor who was just sort of this local Florida guy who was a war veteran and, frankly, a little bit off. And not in a funny way. And when he tried to do the scene, he just couldn't do it. And Harold Ramis, the director, thought, geez, this is the first day, and I know I'm gonna get fired when they see this thing back in Hollywood. So they decided to just move on, get rid of this guy, and they figured when Bill Murray showed up, they would just give the scene to him, and they did, and he just turned it into something that's like poetry.
You mentioned Rodney Dangerfield. And he is Al Chervik. He's unbelievable. His very first scene that they filmed was the infamous pro shop scene. Rodney being used to being on stage and getting laughs. This almost seems sort of foreign because you think of the consummate performers being in front of cameras all the time. But I guess this really wasn't the case. Rodney thought that scene, in which he killed, by the way, he thought that he was bombing over and over again. Why?
Well, I think most stand-up comedians have a slightly neurotic edge and are a little bit insecure. But yeah, Rodney was not familiar with how movies are made. And so he's out there giving it his all, making jokes, some that are in the script, some that aren't. You buy a hat like this, I bet you get a free bowl of soup, all that. He's doing that. And he realizes that no one's laughing. And he's like, I am tanking here. What's going on? And he was really insecure about it. And they finally had to pull him aside and say, no, Rodney, you're doing great. The problem isn't that people aren't laughing. It's that we can't laugh because we'll ruin the take if you hear the crew laughing, on film. So it took him a while to get the hang of things. He didn't even know what the word action meant to start the scene. Eventually they just had to call out, Rodney, do your bit, instead of action at the beginning of all of his scenes.
You mentioned the bowl of soup line. Yet another completely improvised line that's one of the most famous in American comedy. Chris Nashawaty, our guest, Taking Dead Aim, author of the book Caddyshack, The Making of a Hollywood Cinderella Story. Want to talk real briefly about the dynamic between Ted Knight and Rodney Dangerfield. We touched on this earlier. Ted Knight, the consummate, coming from the Mary Tyler Moore Show, the ensemble, the script is the Bible sort of actor, and Rodney, who's completely off the cuff, and the anger we saw on screen from Ted Knight's character, Judge Smales, that may not have taken much acting on his part.
No, I mean, he really was upset with the way that everyone else on the movie was making the movie. It just went against everything he knew about acting. And not only that, but, Ted Knight was older than most of the cast and the crew, who were young and fun and in their 20s and looking to have a good time. And they were in Florida in 1979, which is pretty much the gateway into the country for cocaine. So there's a lot of drug taking on this set, and Ted just wasn't having it. So, Rodney just sort of saying whatever the heck popped into his head, just went against everything that Ted believed in, and he had trouble keeping up. So when you see him just seething in those scenes, it's just, that's what we call method rage.
Get you out of here on this, and this goes to you as a film critic. I was just, as we were talking, trying to think of comedies in the last 10 to 12 years. Big successful ones, maybe The Wedding Crashers, maybe the first Hangover movie. Those are ones that really made me laugh out loud. I don't quote those movies. I don't have their quotes memorized. What is it about these comedies, other than the fact that Bill Murray was in them? You know, Stripes, Meatballs, Caddyshack. I know Bill wasn't in Animal House, but I'm going to throw that in there too. What is it about those movies, those comedies, the Blues Brothers from, you know, 79 to 82? What is it that resonates even to this day with people that they memorize lines and know them, and it doesn't happen today?
You know, it's a good question. I'm not sure I have the answer. I have a couple of theories. The first is that it's like the NBA. You know, as great as everyone is, as many star players as there are, there isn't a Jordan, a Magic, a Bird. You know what I mean? Yes, there's LeBron, but it just seems like the stars were better back in the day. And with the movies, you know, I'd argue that there, you know, a movie like Anchorman or the Austin Powers movies are pretty quotable, but my God, it seemed like there was one coming out every week back in the 70s and 80s. And I just think that those movies, they knew how to make comedies better back then.
Oh, and one more little thing. We talked real quick about the Dalai Lama scene. The poor child who had the pitchfork shoved in his chest for about 7 hours once Bill Murray got there and started filming it was a guy named Peter Burkrot. Now, if I were to ask you what Peter Burkrot is doing today, specifically that has to do with your book, what would you say?
I would say that young man who had a pitchfork aimed at his throat for about 7 hours with Bill Murray, he now reads audiobooks at Audible, and he read the audiobook for Caddyshack, The Making of a Cinderella Story.
How great is that? If you love Caddyshack, and who doesn't, right? I highly recommend Caddyshack, The Making of a Hollywood Cinderella Story. It just was released this week. That's author Chris Nashawaty. And when we return, newly named South Atlantic Conference Coach of the Year, Wingate's Aaron Thorne, takes dead aim at Lady Bulldog Golf, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. We are Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. It's been a great season for Wingate Lady Bulldog Golf, and they're not done by a long shot. Had the chance this week to catch up with head coach Aaron Thorne as practice was a rainout. Congratulations, South Atlantic Conference Coach of the Year, Diana McDonald, Player of the Year, and your team. It's just the success is unprecedented. We'll get to that in just a second. But overall, your overall impressions of this team, you have to be just tickled.
Yeah, I mean, I'm super excited. With one of our players, mine, who ended up winning the conference, she had to sit a year just being a transfer and that sort of thing. And so I knew this year could be pretty special once we actually got her into the lineup after watching her play just like our qualifiers and everything at Rolling Hills last year. But Diana had just a fabulous year, and just everybody else just kind of stepped up a little bit. I mean, Laura dropped, I think, another shot off her season scoring average compared to last year, which, you know, when you're already in the 70s, to drop a shot is pretty impressive. And then adding in Sam, freshman, you know, and what she did was pretty cool.
You played 10 tournaments this year, 10. The worst you finished, the worst was the very first one, fourth place. If you look at college men's rosters, the best men's rosters in the country, they're going to have one or two stinkers in there, a 10th or an 11th place. This is stunning consistency. Is it this uncommon at the women's level to have a team that never finishes out of the top four ever?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it was, like I said, a pretty special year. Diana coming off of her summer tournaments and just continuing such solid play and really carrying us. And I think just the teammates saw what she was doing and just kind of, all right, let's do it all together. And, you know, it was pretty easy coaching. You know, get them prepared, have them focus on the right things at practice, and then just let them go for most of the tournaments.
Erin Thorne is the South Atlantic Conference Coach of the Year. She's the head women's golf coach at Wingate, our guest taking Dead Aim. When we spoke earlier in the year, I looked at your roster then, and I look at your roster now. And, I mean, you have a coach from Canada, you have people from North Dakota and Spain and Thailand. You're a walking United Nations in the locker room. I'm wondering, how important is team chemistry in that locker room when you have such a tight-knit team? We're only talking about 2, 4, 6, 8, you know, 10 girls max and a couple of coaches. Or is it overrated, or do you feel like there's team chemistry? How is the communication amongst the girls?
Yeah, no, I think even in a small team, the team chemistry is important. We've actually had comments from other coaches and other players about our team chemistry and how they wish that they had it. I mean, it's always been one of my big things at taking over the program. That's what I wanted because, you know, just like, you know, basketball or football, if there's not communication, then the plays don't happen. For us, obviously, being an individual sport, like, you still go and play your own ball, but to have somebody walking down the fairway next to you, cheering you on, or, you know, in behind clapping for a birdie putt, or you know, whatever it is, you know, there's that support all the way through the lineup. So it's pretty cool, and I think it did play a big factor into our success this year, because there, you know, were times where each one of them struggled, but the other four picked it up, and it, you know, yeah, you're upset that you didn't play your best, but it was like, hey, the team did awesome. So it was a lot of team before me reactions after not great rounds by any of the individuals throughout the entire year.
You know, sometimes in groups you can have so much diversity that it becomes a hindrance and sets up walls within the group. Do you think there's a commonality in the vast diversity of this group that they found strength in that, hey, we're all sort of outsiders on this thing?
Yeah, I mean, there's just part of the recruiting process for me is talking about, you know, that diversity and how it does help us out, because, you know, we understand better other people's experiences, and, you know, we're not so tied down to just a narrow point of view.
I was talking with the East Carolina head men's golf coach last week, and he's in a unique situation in that his top three players, and this is, you'll know how rare this is, his top three players for the year are within 10 total strokes of each other between one and three. I mean, that just doesn't happen. Your lineup is pretty much set like, you know, 1, 2, 3, and 4 are real solid. Let's start with what Diana McDonald. We mentioned her as player of the year, a fellow Canadian. Talk to me about her season, you know, from start to finish, and how she's sort of established herself as that lead dog.
Yeah. So, I mean, she just started the fall with such a simplistic approach to the game. And one of the mantras through the entire year is we wanted to hit just the fat side of the pin. And she really embraced that, and I think was already doing that in her summer tournaments and just kind of continued on. So that was a big thing. Her greens and regulation in the fall just were sky high. And so when you've got that many birdie putts, eventually even the 30-plus footers are going to fall every once in a while. You know, and she just kind of kept going and you know, made it simple. You know, she struggled a little bit to start the spring season, but, you know, we finally sat down and had some conversations. She owned up to feeling like she was putting a little bit more pressure on herself, being named to the Arnold Palmer Cup watch list at the end of the fall season. So, you know, once that kind of got announced that, you know, she could kind of put it behind her that, okay, it wasn't going to get selected and move on and really focus on the last few tournaments of the year and again, got back to that simplicity, wasn't trying to hit shots that really weren't there or weren't called for at that point in the round, that sort of thing. So she really, you know, again, simplicity works out usually for the better in any situation. With mine, you know, she, you know, I think just so excited to be able to play college golf. She started her college career up at Northern Michigan and it didn't work out, and she found her way down here last year. But like I said earlier, she had to sit a year because of transferring and then, you know, to get in. So she had, you know, a whole bunch of high expectations, and it was really her first go around of okay, missing classes and playing golf and that split attention that, you know, a lot of freshmen kind of experience. How do you actually balance all of that? And then you saw her kind of take off in the spring with having that experience in the fall and shooting some really good scores and just, she had, I guess, a good conversation back home over Christmas break with her dad and just kind of got to the roots of her Buddhist beliefs and everything like that, and it showed up on the golf course. For Laura, I mean, she just has always been my consistent golfer. She, you know, she doesn't kind of follow that whole, like, 10-shot from worst to best kind of idea that even the pros have. She probably only has about a 5-shot swing from her worst to best. I mean, she's always been one where I know what I'm going to count on her, and it's always going to be something that is likely a score we're going to count that day. So that's, as a coach, it's always nice to know that you've got that really solid player that isn't going to, you know, blow up too badly ever. And then, you know, the ones that kind of rotated in and out, especially during the spring, Christina just has that, you know, true Spanish fire to her, and you know, sometimes it's really, really helpful and sometimes it hurts her a little bit, but you know, that's what I love about her and her learning to harness in, you know, when it's going to hurt her, and she's definitely done a good job of that. With Sam, like I said, that freshman, and I see her kind of following Laura's footsteps of she'll knock off almost a full shot each year. She becomes just that little bit more confident in, you know, the maturing process of going into adulthood and balancing academics and golf and that sort of thing. And then, you know, Leanne just figured out, you know, how to play her hook and able to post some good scores for us during the spring season. And so, you know, it was a good battle between the six of them for spots, and they all contributed positively throughout the year.
Erin Thorne is the South Atlantic Conference Coach of the Year. She's the head women's golf coach at Wingate. Our guest taking dead aim. I want to talk about Sam Fritzinger for a minute. You brought her up. She was your freshman, a big contributor. And with every college coach, both male and female, that I've spoken with, one of the things that we talk about is the adjustment just of being a person away from home and at college, and how everyone sort of adjusts at a different pace, because it's, you know, it's being away for the first time. For some people, it's doing their laundry for the first time. It's having to budget your time on your own and not having, you know, a parent over your shoulder for the first time. And, oh, yeah, you're also a college athlete, and you're having to figure all that out. Apparently, she figured all that out really early.
Yeah, I mean, she's such a good person and really mature for her age. I mean, I already see her as being one of the future captains of this team. Just the calmness that she brings about it, the grit and determination that she has, you know, in every single round, even if it's a good round, she's still grinding out every single thing to keep it as low as possible. Or, you know, on the bad day, she's just grinding out, trying to figure out how do I get it in the hole as quickly as I can with, you know, it not looking all that pretty. So I think, you know, again, that translates into her academics and everything like that. She just figures out a way to find that time to get it done, both in the classroom and on the golf course.
Erin, of everyone that we've mentioned on your roster just now, the one commonality is that there's absolutely positively not one senior among them. Now, as good as you thought you might have been, as high as your expectations internally might have been, this team has to have exceeded what you thought it could achieve at this point, yes?
Oh, for certain. I mean, it's a whole bunch of new program heights that we've achieved this year. I mean, at one point being ranked inside the top 10 in the nation, you know, to finish off the year 15th in the nation, like, we've never touched any of that. This is actually the first time in program history that the entire team is qualified to go for NCAA regionals. So it's, yeah, we've surpassed, you know, where we thought we would be, even with the strength of the team that we have this year.
Well, let's talk about that. Where are the regionals being held, and when are they being held?
So we head out for a practice round on May 6th, so actual tournament dates are May 7th to 9th. It's in Germantown, Tennessee, which is a suburb of Memphis.
Yeah. And then where, because I'm already counting, you know, our chickens before they hatch, where do we play for the big title? Where's the national title being held this year?
Yeah, nationals are down in Houston.
One more thing before we get you out of here. This is Erin Thorne. She's the South Atlantic Conference Coach of the Year. Head women's golf coach at Wingate, our guest taking dead aim. I was looking at the conference tournament. Talk to me a little bit about that. It appears that there was a ton of wind where you guys were playing. There were some exceptionally high scores, not just by you guys, but by everyone. What did you run into there?
Yeah, I mean, it was about a 20-mile-an-hour wind sustained, plus the gusts the first couple of days. And there's lots of hazards running along fairways and in front of greens and that sort of thing. So it was definitely already a difficult golf course, just made a little bit more difficult with that wind. But, you know, our girls just had a wonderful mindset for all 3 days and didn't let mistakes affect them for too long, because they knew that that's part of the game normally, never mind when it's blowing like that. And, you know, you could just see it even in the first day, with us being paired with LR, who, you know, we've had a good battle all spring with. Their players were, you could see the visibility of anger and frustration with shots not coming off and finishing where they wanted, whereas our girls, you know, if it didn't quite work out how they intended, they just couldn't, you know, okay, that's where it is, that's where I'm playing from, kind of idea.
Well, that's what I wanted to get to. I wanted to ask you about how you manage the mindset in that situation. I mean, I'm the son of a junior golfer, and he doesn't care if the wind's blowing 50 miles an hour or it's not blowing at all. He expects, you know, the exact same scores every time. And in a situation like that, where the course is already going to be set up difficult, now you got Mother Nature throwing her hand in it too. The scores are going to be higher. How do you manage the personal expectations of what they want to do and what they think they should do based on, hey, girls, look, you're in great shape. Look at these other scores. Par is just a number here. Look at what we're doing as a team, and look what other people are doing.
Yeah, I mean, that's, again, one of the things that I've preached to them throughout the entire year is, you know, that mindset before skill set concept. And, you know, it doesn't matter how pretty your swing is. If you're not thinking right, you're not going to execute it. But truthfully, I'm going to throw the two captains, or two Spaniards, the credit here, because they took it upon themselves to do up a little video of pictures that, you know, we'd captured and videos from the entire year. And then they capped off the video that they made with a little speech, each one of them. And they were the ones that talked about, hey, mistakes happen. You know, just accept them. The team that does that moves on. They're the ones that are going to be hoisting that trophy at the end of it. So, I mean, it's one thing to hear it from me, you know, tournament in, tournament out, but to hear it from a teammate, I think just finally resonated with them, and then they just kind of hung on to that a little tighter than from my mouth, I guess.
She is the South Atlantic Conference Coach of the Year, Wingate's Erin Thorne. I'd also like to thank Chris Nashawaty, author of Caddyshack, The Making of a Hollywood Cinderella Story, for his time this week. A reminder, should you just be catching the last little bit of the show and wonder what all we've covered today, no worries. Just subscribe to the Taking Dead Aim podcast at Apple Podcasts, and it will automatically download to the device of your choice most weeks, just minutes after this terrestrial radio version of the show finishes airing. Additionally, a great source of constant golf updates is our Facebook page. Be sure to like us on Facebook. Just search Taking Dead Aim. Hey, weather-wise, it doesn't get better than this weekend in the Carolinas. To tee it up and let this game continue to haunt our souls and break our hearts, and if you do put a peg in the ground, remember to exhale, swing, pose, and keep it in the short grass. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, at @CLT_golfguy, and I'll see you right here next week, Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors.